If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
If you went on a road trip and you didn't stop for a Big Mac or drop a crispy fry between the car seats or use your McDonald's bag as a placemat, then that wasn't a road trip. It was just a really long drive. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
At participating McDonald's.
It really was the song that made the Germans think for the first time that there was a chance that they were going to lose the war.
That was Andrew Roberts talking about the consequences of the Battle of the Somme.
Anti-unionism was a very strong component of popular support for Jacobitism in Scotland in the early decades of the 18th century.
And that was Christopher Whatley discussing the Jacobites. You're listening to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine. We're the UK's best-selling history magazine, available from all good newsagents or via subscription. Check out our latest subscription deals at historyextra.com/subscribe. The magazine is also now available on many digital devices, including the iPad, iPhone, Kindle, Kindle Fire, Google Play, Kobo and Zinio. Look out for us in your app store or newsstand, or find out more at historyextra.com/digital. Welcome to our third podcast of September 2015. I'm Rob Attar, the editor of BBC History Magazine. Our first interview this week is with Andrew Roberts, a best-selling historian who's written on a variety of subjects, including the Second World War and Napoleon. His new book, Elegy, tells the story of the 1st of July 1916, the day when the Battle of the Somme began. Our reviews editor, Matt Elton, met up with Andrew recently and began by asking him why he'd chosen this topic for his book.
It's always difficult to know whether or not anniversaries are just a useful peg to hang ideas on, or whether or not they are something that's genuinely inspiring and moving. And I think the anniversaries for the First World War have been more inspiring and moving than any other set of anniversaries that I've come across. The trouble with the bicentenary of Waterloo, although it's very grand, is it's 200 years ago. And so you never met anyone who fought in the First World War. Whereas I met plenty of people who fought in the First World War. And so it it does sort of hit you viscerally. It hits you in the gut in the way that you know, the 800th anniversary of Magna Carta, you know, can't and doesn't. Mm. Equally, the really recent ones don't really have quite the same power to grab the imagination. A 50th anniversary or a 75th anniversary or a 30th anniversary, unless they're something to do with you personally, you know, your wedding anniversary or something like that, actually, historically, I don't think have anything like the pull of 100 years. Mm. It's those, you know, a couple of round numbers there that really bring home the thing to you. And that's why I think the poppies in the Tower of London moat the other day, some of the things that the Queen has gone to, certainly what they're getting ready for the Somme anniversary at Thiepval, and Beaumont Hamel and some of the other ceremonies, I think have a real sort of ability to twist the gut. Mm. And that's what's happened to me over this.
Talking about the reasons why the Somme took place, to what extent was the decision to fight there a political rather than a tactical?
It was very highly political, because we needed to help the French at Verdun and stay in the war, which sounds like a strategic military decision, but actually the Somme was chosen because that was where the French and the British armies overlapped, and or at least were adjacent, stood shoulder to shoulder, and so it would come over as a very powerful propaganda move if the two armies could coordinate a big attack. The biggest attack of the war thus far, and that was political.
Talking about the High Command, what problems were there in the run-up to the battle within High Command?
The major problem, of course, was that the British Expeditionary Force, by then under Haig, from December 1915 onwards under General Haig, was subordinate to General Joffre and the French, understandably so, in a way. You know, you're fighting in France, and the French have a much larger army than us, and the overall direction of the war really had to be theirs. But the problem, psychological and political problem, rather, is that Joffre only really believed in attrition and not a war of movement or big breakthroughs. And Haig desperately wanted the big push to result in a breakthrough, and have a much more fluid form of warfare. And it wasn't until 1918, of course, those famous three last months of the war, that Haig got what he wanted. Otherwise, it was the Joffre view of warfare that, of course, triumphed, and as a result left as many dead as the First World War did. So you've got that tension, which was never said in so many words, but we can see that must have been a tension. The second tension, of course, was within the High Command, because Haig only came into his position in the December of 1915, after quite a lot of frankly, rather ungentlemanly jockeying for the post, and that was always highly political. You know, I mean, generals are politicians at the top level anyway. They always are in all wars, and Haig was actually probably a better politician than he was a general, because he got to the top and stayed there for the whole rest of the war, regardless of these massive losses.
And how much was overconfidence a problem in terms of the planning of this operation?
Very seriously, the problem, not so much with Rawlinson. Rawlinson did feel that there was a danger that it wasn't going to come off. But from his diaries, it seems clear that Haig was wildly over-optimistic. And that's not entirely his fault. I mean, Charteris, his chief intelligence officer, did lead him to feel that the Somme was going to be a big victory instead of the worst day in the history of the British Army. And one can see why, you know, the sheer amount of ordnance that they were going to be dropping on the barbed wire and on the German dugouts should, by any normal calculation of war, have meant that it was a walkover and that the men were going to be able to, you know, slowly get out of their trenches and walk across no man's land and just take possession of the first couple of lines of German trenches, possibly only actually having to fight for the third one. For various reasons that I give in the book, dud shells, the fact that barbed wire is an awful lot hardier than it seems.
Yeah.
I mean, it's true that there were some places where the wire was cut, but overall, the men, heavily weighed down with all their equipment, instead came up against uncut wire on all too many occasions. And, you know, ultimately, the intelligence people must bear some blame for that, as must the Royal Artillery.
Mm. This has obviously been the subject of huge amounts of debate. What view do you think we should take of Haig?
Yes, it has been, and I'd love to be... Usually, I take very strong views for or against people. You know, I've been attacked quite a lot for my pro-Napoleon stance. I think I've been objective about Napoleon. A lot of people who've written in about my TV and radio shows don't. So I don't think that at all. But I don't really come down on... I certainly don't come down on the "he was a donkey" line that that Alan Clark and "Oh, What a Lovely War" and various other people have come up with. Equally, I think that although they're very fine historians, that several of the sort of apologists for Haig have, I think, gone a bit too far.
Okay.
He was in command of the army on the day that the British took the largest number of casualties for the smallest amount of ground in the history of warfare.
Mm.
So he must take some responsibility for that, regardless of whether or not he was fabulous in the last 3 months of the war.
Yeah.
Where I think he was good is, first of all, he was a moderniser. He was probably our most best educated a highly intelligent man. The idea of writing him off as some ignorant blimp is monstrous libel on him. And he learned from his mistakes. And that was only because he was capable and the army was capable of learning from the mistakes that we did have those last 3 months of victory after victory.
Going into the operation, to what extent was it widely known what form it was going to take, what was going to happen?
Everyone knew there was going to be a big push in the summer of 1916, and everyone knew that it was going to be on the Somme. And this was one of the major problems with the whole operation. It was common knowledge in all the pubs in Britain, even newspapers referred elliptically to, you know, the big push. The Germans knew perfectly well that what was about to happen. Prince Ruprecht of Bavaria, the German commander of the Sixth Army, was fully apprised of everything. The only question was when. And then when we open up with a week-long barrage, you're effectively telling the Germans when as well as everything
else.
Yeah. But the question is, if the barrage can destroy the German dugouts in the first and second line of trenches, well, it doesn't matter whether they know it's coming or not, because it would be so successful. But the problem was their dugouts were so much better than ours, so much deeper. The speed with which they could win what was called the race to the parapet and get their machine gunners ready to mow down the BEF infantry was not hampered by the artillery barrage.
And the shells didn't work?
I saw Dan Snow's show the other day, very good, I thought, show on the Battle of the Somme, and he puts it at a quarter of the shells not going off. I've seen some historians argue that as many as a third were dud.
Yeah.
And there are various conspiracy theories about this, of course, you know, because we were buying a lot from America at the time, and whether or not there was actual sabotage going on in the American munitions factories with German German-Americans working in them. I don't personally give very much credence to that kind of thing. No, I think it was just that the War Office ordered up the maximum amount of shells with the minimum amount of time, and as a result, you got you just got people cutting corners and selling things that ultimately didn't work. But I do wonder whether or not there was also something a bit deeper than that as well. Even if all the shells had gone off, you know, it takes more than a shellfire to cut barbed wire, we didn't have the knowledge about the creeping barrage, for example, until much later on in the Battle of the Somme. And remember, this book of mine really is only about that single one day. I, in one chapter, take the reader on to what happened on the 15th of September and all the way through to November. But this is not a book about the Battle of the Somme. It's about the 1st of July 1916.
Talking about that day, is it how unfair is it to see the people who fought on the British side as being somehow, like hugely inexperienced and naive? Is that a misguided view of
it? I think it is misguided. I mean, they hadn't seen action before, a lot of them. Not by any means all of them. I mean, lots of them had actually seen action in Gallipoli and had come back, 27th Division, for example. Sorry, 29th Division, for example. But, you know, these guys had been, most of them, volunteering in the autumn of 1914. And so they had been, they'd had 18 months training for this, you know. They were at the peak of their training. They were pretty fit and healthy. Some of them had eaten better food than they had ever eaten in their lives before, you know, which is astonishing. But, you know, the British Army did manage to give three hot square meals a day to soldiers who, many of them, especially from working class backgrounds, had been pretty much undernourished in their lives up until then. So I think it's true to say that this was their baptism of fire, but nonetheless, they performed just as well as men who had seen action for years.
Do we get a sense of what it was like in the trenches waiting for fighting to start?
Yes, luckily, this is a very literate generation, especially the officers. And you know, you can easily go well beyond the famous poetry to read. The Imperial War Museum, for example, has got some wonderful letters, many of them unpublished, in fact, most of them unpublished. And I've managed to get some superb testimonials from people in the testimony from people in the trenches about what it was like. Actually, in a way, although it sounds awful to say it, the Somme wasn't anything like so bad as Passchendaele, for example, because there wasn't mud. It was the 1st of July. It was a hot day, and it had been for much of that summer, and so it wasn't one of those classic First World War battles where people are up to the top of their puttees in the most glutinous mud, which must have been absolutely horrific trying to cross ground under those circumstances with the duck boards and the water and the rats and all the rest of it. And then they had much more of a problem with mayflies and mosquitoes and midges.
And the sun shining on the biscuit tins on their back.
Terrible story. I know, terrible story again. Yes, the biscuit tins, which they cut out these triangles to sew onto their back so that the forward observation officers for the artillery could see where they were and order the barrage as a result. And of course, when the men actually had to try and get back to their own trenches, it also glinted off their backs for the German machine gunners.
For people who might not know, what was the terrain like that this all took place in? What was the landscape like?
Undulating grassland, chalk, and you saw the chalk when the mines exploded. The chalk came down and took minutes to came down and covered everybody in a sort of white chalky substance. This, of course, was it was chalk. It's the same geographical geographical fault line as you get in the South Downs.
Okay.
You know, it goes right the way under the channel and across. So so if you think South Downs, then you've got a good idea of Picardy.
Mm. So all the bombardment had taken place. The order was given for the men to start advancing, which they did really slowly. Do we get a sense of what the Germans made of?
Yes, the Germans were shocked. Mm. They couldn't believe their eyes, because these guys were... It's very important not to generalise too much. You know, there were battalions that crept out before the whistles blew at 7:30 a.m. and there were battalions that ran for it, you know, ran for the German trenches. And so one can't make a sweeping overarching statement, but in the main, the men were ordered to advance at the walking pace because they didn't want to be exhausted, to have the men exhausted when they captured the first couple of lines of trenches. And one can understand if you're carrying what was averaging about 60 pounds on your shoulders, you know, your own kit, but also rolls of barbed wire, sometimes Lewis guns, sometimes Bangalore torpedoes, sometimes stretchers and the rest of it. You know, if you're carrying all that kit on top of the kit that you carry normally, which was also pretty pretty heavy, including water, which of course is the most a cumbersome thing to carry anyhow, then to try and do it even at a trot would leave the men completely breathless by the time they got across no man's land. So in a sense, the walking did make sense. It was just that you know, they should have had it organised in such a way that some of the equipment came up after the trenches were captured, rather than at the same time. But they did believe that the Germans were going to be surrendering and not firing back.
To what extent was a problem the multiplicity of targets something that hadn't been...
A huge problem, yes. The fact is that they were attacking over a very, very wide... 22 miles, if you take into account the French as well. Really massive attack. And there was, you know, a division that wasn't used at all, so an area where the Germans knew they weren't going to be attacked, so they were able to send troops away from that. And there was a diversionary attack on Gommecourt, which led to huge numbers of lives. I mean, you can't tell people that they're fighting in a diversionary attack.
Yeah.
It's impossible to do that for morale reasons. But nonetheless, you know, these guys, it doesn't seem that they actually diverted anything from the Germans. Surely would have been better to have attacked on a less extended front, considering we just didn't have the number. We had an extraordinary number of artillery pieces and shells. You know, 1.6 million shells were expended in the preliminary bombardment and on the day itself. Mm. But nonetheless, as we've mentioned earlier, it just simply wasn't enough.
Which part of the attacking force made the most gains?
The French, down in the south. In fact, it's quite interesting, the more you look at that... at that battle, the further south you go, the better they did. Right at the top, in the northern region, and in the centre really, they got pretty much nowhere. Whereas further on down, when you get to the 36th Ulster Division, and certainly the French, you know, they captured Mametz and various other small villages. But these are tiny little Picardy villages. They're not much different now, actually, from the size that they were in 1916. And none of them had any great strategic importance, certainly not with regard to the losses incurred in capturing them.
And what effect did this single day have on the psychology of the attacking forces and the army more generally?
Well, it's fascinating that it didn't break the morale of the army. You know, you nearly have 50% casualties, which is an unbelievably large number for any engagement at any stage in history. And yet, you know, it's a testament really to the sort of cheerfulness of the British fighting man, who was the British working man, effectively. You know, I mean, these guys had come straight from their farms and offices and factories, and volunteered, and yet even an attrition rate of 50% was not enough to make them. You know, to break their morale in the way that, of course, the French the following year mutinied, the entire Russian army mutinied, and in 1918 the German army mutinied. But there was no question of that happening. You know, these guys in the BEF continued to fight and then went on and launched other major offensives only a couple of months later, in the 15th of September being the classic example of that. So it's just as I said, that the bravery they showed was very moving. I also think the sheer doggedness and willingness to carry on fighting in circumstances where, certainly month upon month upon month, to have survived from the beginning to the end of the Battle of the Somme, when almost certain death faced you. On a daily basis, just is something that almost defies belief.
Mm. And how did it change the Germans' view of the British?
Well, of course, at the beginning, they thought we were mad to have walked over no man's land, carrying £60 of equipment, and, you know, getting no more than a few yards and being cut down. But by the time that the battle ended in November. And it was ultimately, insofar as you can say this, of any kind of engagement where quite so many men have died, it was a British victory. I mean, it pushed the Germans back to the Hindenburg Line. Their respect for us as a fighting nation went up hugely, because we hadn't done terribly well in 1914, 1915. And so, it really was the Somme that made the Germans think for the first time that there was a chance that they were going to lose the war.
Mm. Is it right to see the slaughter as unavoidable, do you think?
No. I mean, it's important that that we retain the offensive and the initiative. You can't just fight the First World War by stopping and hoping that the other side are going to fall to their to your machine guns. Mm. I mean, you don't win wars by not going forward. But, and it's also really true to remember, and in many ways it's ultimately the most important lesson of the Somme, is that the High Command and the General Staff did, and the officers, you know, and junior officers, did learn the lessons. And, you know, you do get the creeping barrage, and you get infantry tactics completely altering. So in that sense, the Somme did lead ultimately to the victory 2 years later. But was that level of blood loss necessary? Is that what you're asking? Well, the answer has to be no. Mm-hmm. I mean, one can never say that the death on one day of over 19,000 people was necessary. Especially for so little ground gained.
Yeah, yeah. What are the consolations from this single day, then, do you think? Are there anything that we can take?
Yes, I think first of all the stories of heroism, the immense courage shown by ordinary people in extraordinary circumstances. That's the first thing. The second thing is the fact that, as I mentioned, the lessons are learned, and you have by 1918 certainly a far more efficient, tougher army, which is ready to break the German army, and so that's a positive, I think. But really, that's all you can take away. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it is a truly, truly terrible story of massacre.
Mm-hmm. But which forced the British army to learn how to kind of win the First World War, I suppose.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. You do see, I devote a chapter to this called Lessons Learned, you do see the way that infantry tactics alter, the way that the artillery uses this creeping barrage, which allows the infantry to move up and win the race to the parapet. And you get a much less, you know, men are allowed to run, to charge. They aren't, in later battles, forced to carry 60 pounds of weight. You know, these are important lessons. I mean, some people can say and have said, well, you should have learned them when you were training rather than... but they learnt that artillery wouldn't always cut the barbed wire, and they also brought in different fuses and different shells, and you get far fewer dud shells as well later on in the war. Better fuses and better shells, which actually can cut wire.
Yeah.
So you have the invention of the tank, of course, because this barbed wire is such a serious thing. Well, the tank just goes straight over barbed wire and trenches. Aircraft reconnaissance is used to a much greater degree and allows us to spot where artillery needs to be concentrated on, and that's a positive. It was a steep learning curve for the British Army, but they did learn, and they learned better than the German Army, and much better than the American Army, actually, which came over, even though it entered the war, you know, 3 years after the war had been declared. It took a lot of pain on their part for them to learn the lessons that had already been learnt by the BEF.
And finally, how would you like this book to change people's views of this one day in history, I suppose?
Well, I mean, in a way, I'd like them... Anyone who still believes in the donkey's theory, this sort of chateau generalship of upper-class twits who didn't care about their men being slaughtered and fighting miles behind the lines and doing it in a moronic way. I hope that actually the sort of Blackadder view of the First World War. I hope this book puts an end to that. Equally. The sort of revisionist lot who make Haig out to be better than he was, I think they have gone too far now. So what I'd like this book to do is to really present a much more rational and, in my view, much more believable view than either of those two extremes.
That was Andrew Roberts. Elegy, The First Day on the Somme, is out now in the UK, published by Head of Zeus. In the US, it is due to be published next month, also by Head of Zeus. And you can read more from Andrew and Matt in the October issue of BBC History magazine, which has just gone on sale. Also in this month's issue, there are articles on the First Emperors of Rome, the Battle of Agincourt, Alan Turing, and interwar Europe, among other things. You can get hold of our October issue in all good newsagents and digitally. And once again for this month, we're continuing our service of providing audio versions of some of the articles. You can listen to these on our iPad and iPhone editions, and also online at historyextra.com/October audio. Meanwhile, here's a reminder that our autumn history weekends are almost upon us. Our event in York begins next week on the 25th of September, while our Malmesbury weekend takes place from the 15th to 18th of October. There are still tickets available to some of the talks at both weekends, so if you would like to come along, it's not too late. Visit historyweekend.com for more details and to purchase tickets.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This year sees a 300th anniversary of the 1715 Jacobite uprising, one of the most dramatic moments in a lengthy battle between the British state and those who wanted to put the House of Stuart back on the throne. To discover more about the story, our deputy editor, Charlotte Hodgman, spoke to Professor Christopher Whatley.
To start off with, who actually were the Jacobites and what did they actually want to achieve?
Right, well, the Jacobites were the followers or supporters of the Stuarts who in the form of James the Seventh of Scotland, James the Second of England, had lost their crowns in England and Scotland at the time of the so-called Glorious Revolution of 1688, early 1689. So they were the Jacobites were the supporters of this this dynasty which had lost its place when William and his wife Mary succeeded to the British thrones, if you like, in 1688. What did they want to do? Well, you've got to distinguish, I think, between the Stuarts themselves and what they wanted and what their supporters wanted. And sometimes there's an overlap, but not always. It's not always the case. Obviously, James the Seventh, and then his son and his grandson, that's James, his son, and then Charles Edward Stuart, the so-called young pretender, Bonnie Prince Charlie, they wanted to regain their British, the British kingdom, if you like, or British kingdoms, or they wanted to become monarchs again. Why they wanted it was because they believed that they, certainly in Scotland, they believed there was an unbroken line of Stuart monarchs going back perhaps a couple of thousand years. That was almost certainly not quite the case, but certainly for many centuries, Stuarts had reigned on the Scottish throne. Different in England, of course, because James the Second had succeeded in 1603, but that was formerly, of course, there was a series of English monarchs, which you will know much more about than I do. In Scotland, the supporters of James and then his son and then Bonnie Prince Charlie wanted a change of religion, because at the time of the Glorious Revolution in Scotland, the Episcopalians had been replaced by the Presbyterians. The Church of Scotland, the Presbyterian Church of Scotland, had been re-established in 1690. Yet under the later Stuarts, after Cromwell, Episcopalian had been the state religion, if you like, in Scotland. There's a distinction between Episcopalianism and Presbyterianism. Both are Protestant, but Episcopalianism involves bishops and more kind of and practices which the Presbyterians had no time for. So there's religion about it. It's about religion. In Ireland, Jacobites wanted the restoration of Catholicism. Supporters there tended to be Roman Catholic, not exclusively, but tended to be Roman Catholic. Whereas in Scotland, there were very few Roman Catholics anyway. But the bulk of support for Jacobites in Scotland was coming from Episcopalians. South of the border in England, most of the support for the Jacobites was coming from a different direction. Now, if you talk about the supporters of the Jacobites, there's a whole variety of factors, and what they wanted will differ in the three kingdoms. Now, what I'm going to focus on is Scotland, which is what I know best. Mm-hmm. And what the supporters of the Jacobites in Scotland wanted was a restoration of the Stuart dynasty. They wanted, by and large, a restoration of Episcopalianism. But there was something else, and it's enormously important in Scotland, and that is they saw the return of the Stuarts as a means of breaking the Union of 1707. So, in other words, in Scotland, there was a what you might call a nationalist tinge. And some historians would put it more strongly than that. There's certainly a nationalist dimension to the support there was for the Jacobites because James Stuart and indeed Charles Edward Stuart, Bonnie Prince Charlie, both committed to breaking the Union of 1707 if they were, you know, returned to their thrones. Mm-hmm. And the Union of 1707 in Scotland was certainly in the first decades after 1707 enormously unpopular for a variety of reasons. And so while you could even argue that, you know, Charles James and then his son Charles Edward Stuart were not hugely popular, they were pretty popular, but not hugely popular, less popular was the Union of 1707. And so anti-unionism was a very strong component of popular support for Jacobitism in Scotland in the early decades of the 18th century. Some historians of Jacobitism, including Alan MacInnes, have been arguing that what Jacobitism was a movement rather than a series of episodes, and so that behind the scenes, behind these military adventures, or whatever you want to call them, these attempts to restore the Stuarts by the use of force, behind that there is a movement. There are networks across Europe of Jacobites, which manifests themselves in a variety of ways. So Jacobitism begins almost the day that James loses his British thrones, and it carries on behind the scenes often, but periodically in a military sense, right through to the middle of the 18th century.
Who led these people? You know, who?
Well, there were people in all of the three kingdoms who were consistent supporters of the Jacobites, yeah? Mm-hmm. As indeed there were people on the other side, the anti-Jacobites, who are consistently anti-Jacobite. But what tended to be the case was that the different periods of physical force Jacobitism, if you like, were led by different individuals. So, for example, in the period immediately after James the Seventh and Second lost his thrones, the main leader in Scotland was Graham of Claverhouse, Bonnie Dundee, better known as. He was a great military leader, but unfortunately was killed at the Battle of Killiecrankie, which and as a result of that, or partly as a result of that, perhaps even largely as a result of that, that Jacobite attempt, if you like, failed. In 1714-15, the leader of the Jacobite movement in Scotland was the Earl of Mar. He was again not the best. He was not the most prudent, wisest, most capable military leader. And it's argued too then that the movement failed when, as a result of his leadership. There were other attempts in 1719, 1745, and they were led, if you like, by others.
James Francis Edward Stuart himself, did he sort of have an active role in leading the movement?
Yes and no. James, the original James the Seventh and Second, he was certainly very active in the field, if you like, as well, in Ireland. In terms of 1714-15, James, that's his son, didn't arrive in Scotland until after the rising had begun. Mm-hmm. Although obviously he knew about it, but he didn't arrive until after the action begun. And in 1745, Charles Edward Stuart, Bonnie Prince Charlie, was there more or less from the outset. They were always obviously in the loop and committed, but they didn't until 1745-46, didn't take a leading role in terms of the military campaigns. Each time there were a set of men, officers, if you like, who led the military aspect of these campaigns. And each one of these events is different. So, I know you'd like, well, not you, because I know you take this seriously, but a lot of people would like this all to be very simple. But in fact, each of the so-called risings is, or attempts at regaining the throne, it has a different character. So, for example, 1708, which is one we've mentioned, but we haven't said much about, that was in part inspired by a spy in Scotland who made it clear to the French that the Union was enormously unpopular and that and was convinced that the Scots would rise if the French supported an invasion. Louis XIV, who was the French king at the time, was not uninterested in what was going on in Britain, mm-hmm. Because, of course, the last thing that Louis XIV wanted was a union of England and Scotland, which had happened the previous year in 1707. So that was the 1708 attempt, invasion attempt, was very much French inspired, although the French commander of the fleet wasn't hugely enthusiastic about his mission, and that was one of the reasons that didn't succeed. When in fact, 1708, had the French forces landed, it is argued, and certainly by Daniel Secchi, that could have been a success for the Jacobites, because the Union had only been, forged or forced through the Scottish Parliament 12 months previously, and as I say, it was enormously unpopular at this particular time. Mm. And with the Jacobites assuring Scots that they would be overturning the Union, you can see why there would be such popular support for them.
Mm. What about Bonnie Prince Charlie? I mean, people seem to have lots of different opinions about him. Mm-hmm. I mean, what was his role? And I mean, how useful was he, to the cause? Did he sort of help or hinder it, would you say?
Well, he that's an interesting question. Help or hinder it? Well, obviously he helped it in the sense that he had to be there. He was certainly a charismatic character, and whether or not he was charismatic, he certainly managed to when he did come to Britain, Scotland for the 1745, if you like, he did turn out the crowds, particularly women, it has to be said, who cheered him in the streets of Edinburgh and Glasgow and so on and so forth. He was the figurehead, and he was an attractive, relatively young man at the time, and said many of the right things in the sense that he knew which strings to pull, if you like, politically, in terms of his messages about breaking the Union, for example, would be one of them. So in that sense, he was a good thing, obviously. Yeah. Well, on the other hand, it does appear that he took the advice of the wrong officers. He had a group of officers, military officers, advising him on the campaign, and he tended to side with some Irish officers who appear to have been less prudent than some of the others who were urging more caution about the campaigning, about where to fight the battles and so on and so forth. So in that sense, his judgment was probably not the best.
That was Christopher Whatley talking to Charlotte Hodgman. You can read more from them in the October issue of BBC History magazine, which, as I mentioned earlier, is currently on sale. And just before we go, we're currently running a survey to find out what you think about this podcast, and whether there are any aspects that we could improve. We'd very much appreciate your feedback, so if you do have a couple of minutes to spare, please visit historyextra.com/podsurvey. Well, that is pretty much it for this week, but do please listen in next time when we'll be broadcasting a lecture from our 2014 History Weekend. Thanks for listening to this History Extra podcast, which was produced by Jack Fletcher. Do let us know what you think about this episode by emailing podcast@historyextra.com, and we might read out your messages in future episodes. Alternatively, why not keep in touch via Twitter or Facebook, where you'll find us at History Extra. For more great history content, don't forget to visit our website, historyextra.com, where you will find history quizzes, galleries, articles, and more. Plus, it's where you can download every single previous episode of this podcast.